free, but it's not cheap. Redemption cost God His only begotten Son. But His only begotten Son did it volitionally. His unique Son, His eternal Son, volitionally bore our sins. So grateful for that. My mother was saved when I was nine maybe. First I heard the gospel. I was nine. I remember the man who said it. And every good thing, when I spoke at my mother's funeral, I'm religious George in our family. It's one of the unfortunate things that happens when you're a pastor. I mean, anybody in the family that needs something done, I hope they don't hear this tape. Yeah. They need something religiously done, they call Ron. My uncle dies in Florida, call Ron. Anyhow, I buried most of my mother and my father. But at my mother's funeral, I said, in all honesty, every good thing that has come into my life has come because of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Yes, every good thing that happened. Can mark it. Whoops. I told Jane I didn't think that paper was straight. Oh, I'm supposed to glue it this way. Every good thing that's happened in my life come by the gospel of Christ. I'm very grateful. It wasn't cheap, but it's free. All right, we've reached the second thing that we feel is very important in 18th century America, page 13, which I entitled, "We're Struggling Toward Religious Liberty," and the Constitution will settle the issue. 18th century America, top of the page, witness first, westward movement of the frontier to the Appalachians and then beyond to the Mississippi. There was an enormous upsurge in population. The New England went from 90,000, that is around 1700, you're 90,000. At 1790, the first census were 360,000 in New England. Middle colonies go from 50 to 270,000. The southern colonies from 100,000 to 500,000. You can take those statistics and just keep adding them until you get to 1996, and people are still fighting to get into the United States and finding every loophole and avenue and river or anything they can get to get into this country. If Christianity is so limiting in terms of liberty, why the heck is everybody trying to get here? Why wouldn't they go to these other places? Of course, Christianity is also the basis for our economic prosperity, and maybe that's why they're all trying to get here, huh? They want some of your money. I don't blame them. Do you? You ever been to Mexico, northern Mexico? You ever been to any of the border towns? Wouldn't you try to get across the river to the north? People have been trying to get here ever since. Revivals continue, but the Civil War dominates the last half of the century. Church leaders strive to shore up ecclesiastic control along the lines of Europe. Those two statements are out of place. Excuse me, that Civil War thing is out of place. That should have been in the 19th century. I made a mistake when I proofread this. Not Jane's fault, it's mine. Churches become more and more Americanized. The Revolutionary War is going to dominate the last part of the century, not the Civil War. Maybe you can correct that in your notes. Okay, there is a phenomena that happens that is totally unexplainable, apart from the moving of the Spirit of God, that's called the First Great Awakening in America, 1726 to 1744. Now, please notice the dates on that First Great Awakening, point two, 1726, and I have a circuit in front of it. The last time I was here, I thought I had... Did I point out to you how the secular humanists are now trying to to change this terminology. We would call this AD, right? Stands for what? Anno Domini, the year of our Lord. Where the secular humanists would call this now what? CE, which means what? Common era. And anything before the cross by the secular humanists will be BCE, before the common era. So all you kids that are going to high school now, you will not have BC, which originally stood for what? Before Christ, you will now have this garbage to contend with. What will our history books look like 50 years from now if time goes on, if the secular humanist has his way? This was known as AD. Anything on this? Of course, the guy who coined up this terminology, he missed it by 4 years, but still, it showed the influence of the church, right? Exiguus, a monk in the 4th century, came up with the dating system, and he was off by 4 to 6 years. But still, does it show the influence of Christianity and Western civilization that we've always used these terms? Of course it does. But now the secular humanist says, I can't tolerate that. Let's change this. And who wins out in the textbooks in the schools? Secular humanists. Boy, what kind of rabbits we can chase. Something begins to happen in the United States around the 26th year of the 18th century that is just absolutely unexplainable apart from the Spirit of God. And so on your page, I listed 5 names. Some of them you may have never heard of. Whoever heard of Theodore Frelinghuysen? Or Frelinghuysen. Anybody ever hear of him? You probably never heard of him. So I'm just going to put his initials because I don't want to take time to spell it out. I'm going to tell you why I put him in because I want to show you something. This is TF. He was Dutch Reformed, New Jersey. Okay? The next man that we have on there are the Tennant brothers. The Tennant brothers were Presbyterians. Okay, these are Presbyterians. And they are in PA and New Jersey. Eastern PA and New Jersey. Jonathan Edwards is the man I mentioned this morning, and he is Congregational, 5-point Calvinist in terms of soteriology, completely Puritan, brilliant man, graduate of Princeton when he was a very young man and so on, and a pastor of the Salem church that his grandfather pastored and in Northampton, Mass. Not Salem, Northampton, Congregationalist. So he is in Massachusetts. The next man on the list is George Whitefield. Often his name is spelled Whitfield, it's spelled two ways. And George Whitefield is an absolute Calvinist, Anglican. And he is from England. He's not from the United States. I wanted to have time to read to you about this phenomenon, but I don't. I can only tell you some sporadic things and then few things about it because I have to move on. Now, from 1726, beginning with Frelinghuysen and the Tennant brothers down in Pennsylvania, an amazing thing begins to happen. People begin to volitionally seek the Lord. Hundreds upon hundreds of people get saved. Now, folks, we're in the year 1726. There is no television. There is no radio. There are no telephones. If you wanted to go somewhere, you rode on a horse or you walked. Most people walk because they couldn't afford a horse. It was a day of buggies for those who had the money to have a buggy. Not many could have that. And this phenomena begins to spread. And what is the first thing that you noticed about all these people? Are there any theological identities with these people? No, they're all Calvinists. They're all five-point Calvinists in terms of soteriology. Well, by the time it gets to New England, in Jonathan Edwards' era, and he gets up one, it's already beginning to happen, he has prostitutes start to come to him and weep and interview with him. He writes about this, he writes a history of this. He writes a sermon called The Sinner in the Hands of an Angry God. Now, he had a really high-pitched voice. And sermons in the Puritan days, they lasted 2 hours. When you came to church, it was an all-day affair. Well, after all, I mean, you know, I'm not going to, you know, drive home and then drive back. It's too far. So he just came, and, you know, everybody sat for 2 hours. Now, has anybody here ever read a Puritan sermon? A few have read a Puritan sermon. Okay? Was it easy reading? No. I have a copy of Sinner in the Hands of the Angry God. And I read Sinner in the Hands of the Angry God. It's the most boring thing. I mean, I'm just trying to be honest, folks. From my opinion. I just... That guy just goes on and on. And he read this thing. He read this thing. He read his sermons. And he had a high-pitched voice. There was no emotional aspect about it all. And people began to fall under conviction. And this revival breaks out in New England in 1738 and lasts till 1744. Now that's a long time, folks. That's 6-7 years. Now, how did it manifest itself? Did they put up a tent and in the newspaper say, hey, big meeting tonight, everybody come out? No. No. They just went right on like they always did. They had Sunday morning service. They had a Wednesday service. That was it. They didn't have any special meetings. They didn't say, we're having special meetings. You know, everybody come. The PR agent didn't go in and say, let's organize all the churches ahead of time. You know, an evangelist bought a white suit and a throat mic. And then took a couple shots of adrenaline ahead of time. He already was hyperthyroid when he started. Evangelism had changed a little bit, but when I was a young man, I defined evangelism in the United States as a guy who sets off the same set of firecrackers in a different place every week. Yeah, absolutely none of that. Absolutely none. Just the regular old wicked, and people are getting saved by hundreds and thousands in New England. And the name that's applied to it is the Great Awakening. All historians refer to it as the Great Awakening. And there absolutely is no explanation of it apart from a very, very unique moving of God and a volitional response among people of New England of this time. Along comes George Whitefield. Now here is a firecracker, but a genuine, he's a five-point Calvinist. He's not a Methodist. He's not a Pentecostal. He's a Calvinist. And he's a good friend of John Wesley, who is somewhat Arminian in his theology, or becomes Arminian, or has a strange theology. I'm sorry about that, folks, if you have a Methodist background. Somebody asked George Whitefield if he'll see John Wesley in heaven. You know what Whitefield said? Whitefield says, I doubt if I'll see him. He'll be so close to Jesus Christ and I'll be so far back, I don't know if I'll get to see him. That's the respect he had for John Wesley. John Wesley was some guy, I'll tell you. John Wesley would ride horseback 50, 60, 70 miles a day and speak 3 or 4 times. In his lifetime, he rode over 200,000 miles on horseback in England. When they kicked him out of the Anglican church, he says, I'll go out. The earth is my parish. I'll speak from a tombstone if I have to. John Wesley was some guy. By the way, for those of you who have a Moravian background, a Brethren background, John Wesley, when he came to the United States, he wasn't saved. He was an Anglican priest. He came to Georgia with his brother. And on the boat, Can you imagine coming across the ocean in one of those boats? Anyhow, there was a terrible storm, and Wesley just was in terror. And all these Moravians are sitting around singing hymns and praying, very godly people, sure of their salvation, knew if they die, they're going to heaven. And this had a profound effect on John Wesley. He never forgot it. And John Wesley got saved then. He tells you the date, the time, the hour he got saved. Well, Whitfield was a friend of Wesley, but he's of a different theology. So while Wesley is doing everything in England, Whitfield finds fruitful soil in the United States. He makes 5, 6, 7 trips to the United States. And he had a booming voice. And he was promoting orphanages in Georgia. He was an Anglican. Georgia was an Anglican colony. And so he'd take collections for these orphanages. And Ben Franklin, who was kind of an enigma in terms of religion, he befriended Whitefield. And later, Franklin says, if you go to hear George speak, make sure you go without any money in your pocket, because he's going to have all your money before he leaves. Now listen to this. When word got out that George Whitefield was coming to Philadelphia, 6,000, 10,000 people showed up. Well, the population was only about 12 or 14. And he had to speak outdoors. There was no place that could hold the crowd when he spoke. And he brought them the gospel head on. These people spoke about the depravity of man, about sin, and the hopeless condition that man is in without Jesus Christ. That was the theme. Of all of these men, apart from Jesus Christ, we are hopelessly lost. And thousands upon thousands of Americans got saved. It must have been a marvelous time. If you ever have the opportunity, I encourage you to read Jonathan Edwards' treatise on this strange awakening, this strange movement of God on New England at this time. Well, I must give you some results of this because this is a very, very important phenomena in American church history. So I want to give you, and you'll have to find some, there's a little room at the bottom for results. The first result, of course, was that the churches were multiplied. Not only the membership in the existing churches, but new churches. So we could say, I guess, existing churches were strengthened and new churches were multiplied. In congregational New England, and you would find this in Gaustad's atlas, there were approximately a population of 300,000 at the time. In 1790, there's 360,000, and you sort of try to reason back, and you say there's about 300,000 people. Well, approximately 30 to 50,000 people were saved in New England. They didn't keep lists, you know. How many conversions did you have? They didn't keep these kind of lists, you know. How many joined the church? Well, now, joining the church was kind of a formal thing. They might have that because that was very important in New England. But they did try to keep some list, you know, so this guy could go back with statistics and say, we had over 300 people. Or we had going on, they would say it this way, nowadays. We had going on 300 people. You know what that means nowadays? If we say that nowadays, that means you had 201. See, we got this idea in America that if you're not in a building program, and if you're not keeping statistical count, and you don't know how many have been there, and so on and so on, you're not doing anything. Rubbish. Absolute rubbish. God isn't doing anything. You know, I was talking to Tommy Ice, and I talked to Charlie Clough, and they have some contacts with doctrinal people on the West Coast. And this is circulating now among our think. It's getting more difficult and more difficult to spend 45 minutes in sound exegetical teaching with believers because they can't take it. And I say, hey, if that's your experience, that's one thing, but don't stop. Because some will take it. Some will. And they'll be the leaders. Don't give up on it, whatever you do. See, we got this soundbite mentality. See, since I've been... I do more parenting now. I have a 9-year-old son. I'm Mr. Mom right now. See, I'm sort of semi-retired. So I take the kids to school. I'm the delivery person. Oh, God. Gee, I feel like going back to work, really. But okay, I'm there at 7 o'clock, and I turn on Good Morning America. Okay, here's Good Morning America. Here comes on a guy, and they raise a real important issue. Here we're going to have, we're going to talk to this guy. 20 seconds they talk about the issue, and I'm just saying, gee, boy, I wonder what's he going to say next? They say, well, okay, thanks a lot for coming. It's nice to have you here. Goodbye. So I said to Tommy Heiss, I says, you know what our problem is? We got the soundbite mentality in America. We're so influenced by television that when somebody says something with some meat on it, and you go to try to develop it and establish something, you don't even have time. So when I come to a conference like this and people listen to this stuff that I'm pouring out here for an hour, I say, God, there's hope as far as I'm concerned. It's so encouraging to me. You can't understand how I go home from these meetings. Last time I was here in October, I went back and I said, you won't believe what happened out there. These people kept coming back. I expected to start with a handful and end up with maybe two. How did I get off on that, really? Oh, in New England. And at that time, those services lasted, you know, it would seem like they'd be in perpetuity to us now. But anyhow, thousands were saved, and the revival was doctrinal in emphasis. Oh, they did not have altar calls. Do you hear me? They didn't have altar calls. That didn't happen until the revivals of the 19th century. When the revivals spread to the frontier, and they got very emotional. I don't know how I have time to talk about that. Number two, first result, great increase in the churches. The second result was that it united many of the colonists. See, word of this would spread. Did you hear what's happened down in New Jersey? Did you hear what happened in Western Pennsylvania? In Massachusetts? And Whitfield, when he came, he would come down, he'd come to Charleston, and he'd just get on a horse and work his way all the way up the coast. Sometimes he would sail up and work his way back, but you get a good account of George Whitefield, and you'll see he just went all over the East Coast speaking, everywhere, south, north, everywhere. But the phenomena seemed to be more pronounced from Pennsylvania on. Quakers, Lutherans, Mennonites, Baptists in the South, all responded to this message. So it, point two, this is sort of a fringe benefit, it united many in the colonies in the sense of a movement. Even though they didn't have the communication we had today, at least they became solidified about the gospel. Another very, very critical result, and here this always follows whenever you have doctrinal reformation, this always follows there is a new basis for education. This is point three. Basis for new emphasis. Every time you have revival, you have a new emphasis on education. You know, in the Catholic Church, you hear me, some of you who are Catholics, were Catholics, and maybe you're still a Catholic. I'm not here to attack you, but let me tell you something. There was never a movement for education in the Catholic Church till there was a doctrinal reformation in the 16th century. And the movement for education in the Catholic Church came through the Jesuits. The Jesuits never existed till after the doctrinal reformation. Ignatius Loyola had only 10 members when the Council of Trent began in 1542. And one of the emphases of the Counter-Reformation, that is, the Catholic response to the Protestant doctrinal Reformation, was we have to educate. And the Jesuits took over that responsibility. But that never happened until there was a doctrinal Reformation, because Luther and Melanchthon and all the reformers said, our people have to read so they can read God's Word. See? In the United States, from this, watch, Princeton. Princeton, 1746, Presbyterian. Now, up until this time, there were only three colleges. Remember, they started Harvard. Harvard was 1636, Congregational. William and Mary, 1693, Anglican, Virginia. Yale, 1701, Congregational, Massachusetts. Okay? So up until this time, only three colleges. Now, Princeton, 1746. University of Pennsylvania, Bania. University of Pennsylvania, 1753. This is non-denominational. But the Tennant brothers said, we have to have some way of training clergy locally. So they set up what they call log cabins. And they were called log cabin colleges. And there was a log cabin college in Philadelphia, and there were log cabin colleges in New Jersey. And one of those log cabin colleges became Princeton, and one of the log cabin colleges became the University of Pennsylvania. They had their sources in evangelical Christianity through the Tennant brothers, as did every major university in the United States, had its roots in evangelical Christianity. Thirdly, King's College. Now, King's College, what denomination do you think that would be with that name? King's College. What? Anglican, yeah, of course. And this becomes what? Columbia University. Yeah, that's right. Hotbed of liberalism. Yes. Yeah.
I think so. Okay. Weren't they also Anglican, or did I get that wrong in your lecture last night?
By this time, almost all of New England, in whatever expression you have, reaching down into Pennsylvania, even Virginia, even down in the South, can take this like an umbrella term, Anglican, and put over it. But Presbyterianism, like the Puritan separatists, they would be persecuted and they go over to Holland. Then they would come back to England. Then they came to the United States. So they're finding in the United States sort of a relative independence from Anglicanism. Yeah. Congregationalists, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, like on that chart you have, chart on who were the Puritans, and that chart that delineates them, they all come out of that Anglican umbrella. But they're going to have to leave eventually. King's College is Anglican. Fourth. Rhode Island College, which is now Brown College, or Brown University. 1764, Baptist. Okay. Rutgers College. These are all familiar names to you folks. New Jersey. 1766, Dutch Reformed. Dartmouth College, University. Many of these schools are now Ivy League schools. New Hampshire, 1769, Congregational. So one of the results was a new emphasis on education everywhere. The fourth result was renewed missionary interest. Renewed missionary interest. And who would be the object of missionary interest on the continent at this time? Indians. And you have David Brainerd going to the Indians. You have Jonathan Edwards. Dartmouth College started, one of the purposes of Dartmouth College was to educate Indians. The Baptists, who were highly emotional and dramatic in their preaching, did not, and the Presbyterians, the Tennant brothers particularly, they didn't worry too much about ordained ministers. Now, I don't know if you folks know how much people put on this stock of ordination. You know, everybody asked me, are you ordained? I said, yeah, I'm ordained. Well, who ordained you? And I say, God ordained me. He gifted me and he ordained me. And then Holly Hills Bible Church set me apart as their pastor. That's my understanding of ordination. It is not a bunch of ministers that ordain somebody. It is a local assembly that says, hey, will you be our pastor? We separate you to us. Would you do that for us and be our pastor, our shepherd? I think that's scriptural ordination. There's nothing wrong with other pastors saying, we agree that this man is gifted for this function, but they do not ordain you from a biblical sense. But there are people who just worry themselves to death about this ordination. Who was it that said, was it Spurgeon said, empty hands on empty head? So obviously, then, if these Tennant brothers are promoting this and the Baptists are promoting this, then there's going to be conflict with the establishment, right? Problem of authority. So one of the things that results is division. Now, believe me when I say that what passes for ordination nowadays, I feel is non-scripture. That does not mean that I do not believe somebody who stands behind a pulpit shouldn't be knowledgeable. But my insistence is that he be biblically knowledgeable, that he communicate God's word. That's his major, major task. And he dare not be ignorant in it. And that is what Paul says. You don't appoint an elder who is a novice or a beginner. You're careful about that. Well, denominations now split. Okay? The Presbyterians split. The old side Presbyterians, they're against revival. The new side Presbyterians, they're for revivals. And then Jonathan Edwards is on the side of the new side Presbyterians. Some of them call them the old lights and the new lights. Jonathan Edwards then writes a defense in 1746 called A Treatise Concerning Religious Affection, True and False Revivalism. Gilbert Tennant says, books and schools do not make ministers. Ministers are made by following the Lord and his word. Gilbert Tennant writes, the danger of an unconverted ministry. Well, that becomes a threat to somebody who's in the ministry who may not be saved. And see, John Wesley now is on the scene in England, and many Methodists are coming to the United States because they're very evangelistically fervent. And John Wesley was an Anglican priest for many years, and he wasn't a believer. So when he starts preaching the necessity of the new birth in England in the Anglican Church, the fur flies and eventually he is kicked out. But he sees himself, John Wesley saw himself always as an Anglican. Always as an Anglican. There are, did I say five things? No, I didn't say five results. Good thing, because I got a couple more. Here is a great thing. The Great Awakening, and this has now been established pretty well in a book, and I'm sorry I don't have that. I wanted to have that name for you. The Great Awakening. Trying to search for a word. It prevented, among other things. It was not the only thing. It prevented, among other things. The great respect for common law helped this too. Excesses and radicalism in the American Revolution. In the American Revolution, we were looking for freedom, weren't we? We were looking for representation, or no taxation without representation. We had had it with George III. We had had it with all that line of kings. We had had it with the Stuarts. Now, can you imagine how dumb a Stuart king could be? Here comes a Stuart king, and he's a Catholic, James II, and he marries a countess from Italy. This is an English king. And he's very pronouncedly Catholic. And he's way down in, 1685 in England. And then he sends Governor Andros. He says, I'm tired of those colonists rebelling against the king. I'm sending you to Boston to establish the church. Around 1686 or 87. And here comes this Andros, Governor Andros. He comes into Boston, and the first thing he says, we're going to establish the Anglican Church and set up the Book of Common Prayer. And here are these people that have been here for 150 years, Puritans, Congregationalists. What do you think they're going to do? Can you imagine a king being that dumb? Yeah, you can. You can. That's one of the problems with kingship. So in England, they said, we've had it with you, brother. You could go out the back door and get over to France, or you're going to go the way of Charles I, which meant... And James was smart enough, in that case, to say, I'm going, I'm leaving, while I got a chance. And so England has a glorious revolution. No blood, nobody killed. And Charles II, who was also a Catholic sympathies, and he was restored after Cromwell, and he hadn't been married, and he had a daughter named Mary, and she was a Protestant, and she fled England and went over to Holland, and she married some rich Holland guy named William, and he was a wealthy landowner. And so the British say, well, there is an heir to the throne, and she's Protestant. Hey, Mary, hey, William, bring your husband back, we'll make you king and queen. Oh, wait a minute. We will make you king and queen? The people will tell who is the king and queen? Yes. Called the Glorious Revolution in England. No blood, no mess, no fuss. 1688. American Revolution. 1776 to 1781. What are they revolting against? Didn't have representation. Tired of all the dictation from England. Say, hey, we're going our way. Write the Declaration of Independence, put their lives on the line, sign the Declaration of Independence, which meant they put their lives on the line, these guys. We're going to get to that. How am I doing for time? Are they going to have a bloodbath in America? What about all the Anglicans in America? Is the majority of the population Anglican? Yes. Do they love the king and queen? Yes. Are they loyal to the king and queen? Yes. Is it hard for them to revolt against the king and queen? Yes. Is it hard for the Puritans? Yes. Had to have a change in thinking. Is it hard for all of them? Yes. But they say, this is wrong. The king is wrong. And we're going to tell him where to go. And they do it. They do it in a nice way. But then after the war, they don't kill everyone who was neutral. There's no bloodbath. There's no violence. There's no radicalism. These are solid people leading our country into a new phase of its history. All right, let's go to France. What's going on in France? France has a revolution. 1789 to 1795. How did the revolution start in France? Well, here's what happened. There was an upper crust. I call them the economic elect. Boy, when I see a Christian that has this attitude of the economic elect, I resent that attitude. If you're economically in a bracket, you're there by the grace of God. You may have worked hard. You probably did work hard. You probably worked harder than other people in America, but you better give God the glory, brother. Well, here's this upper crust in England, or in France. You know, they all wear wigs, and they pattern themselves after Louis XVI, and every court in Europe mimics Louis XVI. They all wear these ruffly, fluffly things. They look like a bunch of women, you know. And there's a middle class moving on and getting wealthy, but they couldn't bust in. They couldn't bust into the upper class. And they start the French Revolution. The middle class started it. I don't know in America, I don't know what's going to happen in America, and I'm not a radical. I'm not a radical. But we're coming to a, I think, from my, this is just an opinion, I think we're coming to a place in America where the middle class is going to have to say, enough is enough. Enough is enough. Elitists from the East will not run this country. I think it's coming. I'm not a prophet, nor the son of a prophet. But I'm like horse manure. I've been on the road, brother. What happened in France? There was an authoritarian, ruthlessly authoritarian church that went right along with all this other garbage with the royalty. They were in bed with each other. The Pope was in bed with everybody. And the poor people are financing this whole thing. There was a ruthlessly authoritarian monarchy that had no respect for the common man. They just looked down their nose at everybody. And they said, we're blue bloods. We're really somebody. And there was a violent, violent reaction. And they took Louis XVI, and they took Marie Antoinette, and they took every royal person they could lay their hands on, and they put them under the guillotine. And blood, can you imagine the blood? It was a bloodbath. So what started with the middle class worked its way down to the common man, and it became anarchy. That didn't happen in America. That didn't happen in England. And the reason it didn't happen is because of Christianity. France had suffered the effects of rationalism, the Enlightenment, and the overthrow of theism. And they paid a price for it. And the Reign of Terror, listen to me, the Reign of Terror lasted from 1793 to 1795. It was a bloodbath. You could turn your neighbor in and they'd take him to the guillotine. Didn't happen in the United States. Great Awakening was a great contributing factor to no excess in our revolution. Okay? The last thing, there was an increased emphasis on freedom. Increased, this is from the Great Awakening, emphasis on freedom. Hence, opposition to slavery, including Anthony Benezet, the great Quaker from Pennsylvania, vehemently opposed slavery before the Civil War. This included opposition to slavery. Okay? Okay, any questions on the Great Awakening? A major, major happening, lasted at least 20 years. In the early part of the 19th century history of the church in America, and led to many, many good things. Any questions we can answer? Yes, question. Number six. The Great Awakening prevented, among other things, that's a little inaccurate. The Great Awakening prevented excesses and radicalism in the American Revolution. Now, there were, what I mean among other things is I've got the subject of this little thing, Great Awakening. What I mean is other things prevented the excesses also, but the Great Awakening was a major contributing factor as in excesses of the American Revolution. How would you feel if you went to war to fight the British, and your neighbor who was a loyal Anglican couldn't bring himself to do it? How would you feel after the war? Maybe you got your legs shut off. How would you feel if you're a basketball player making $2 million a year almost, and you won't stand for the national anthem, and you say, America is the evil enemy? How would you feel? I went to war to fight for that guy to have the right to do that. I don't like that he did it. And if his religion says it's difficult for him to stand, that's okay with me. But for him then to make these other remarks that we're the evil nation, I have trouble with that, brother. I have trouble with that. Yeah. You see what I'm saying? How would you feel you went to war and your neighbor says, I have to be loyal, and maybe you lost a loved one in the war? Very difficult to handle, but no bloodbath after the war. No coming back and saying, hey, we're going to get rid of you. None of that. Questions? Okay, very, very quickly. Next page, which continues great happenings in the 18th century. The War for Independence. In general, War for Independence, can't say a whole lot. Baptists were for it. Any Methodists that were around were for it. Lutherans were for it. But you know, they were minuscule, as we showed on that paper. Remember our paper on terms of the population? There weren't too many of these people. Most of them around the middle colonies. The Anglicans, of course, they were torn by it. But many Anglicans were for it. Okay? And the majority, of course, we'd have to say were for it. So in some ways, the War for Independence brought then division among churches. I don't want to spend time on that. I have to move on to the framing of the Constitution. And before I do it, I simply want to read some references to God in the Declaration of Independence. And then we're going to move on, I guess, tomorrow. Is my 60 minutes are not up. By the way, I really appreciate your patience in this thing. It's such a massive amount of material, and I have to be very selective. And it's the first time I've done this, so I'm struggling with trying to bring this down where it's meaningful and yet at the same time communicate certain things. And we're going to deal in the next session tomorrow morning with the framing of the Constitution. And I do not have this in your notes, but I'm going to make reference to God in the Declaration of Independence. And who wrote it? Who wrote the Declaration of Independence? 1776. Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson. Now, as we said, Thomas Jefferson was not a Christian in the sense that we understand Christian. He had been influenced by the rationalists of Europe and by deism. However, he does a very unique thing. In the Constitution, or in the Declaration of Independence, he makes four references to God in this way. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature natural law, but he doesn't stop. And I would like to say that God reached over the parapets of heaven and whispered in Jefferson's ear and said, you better add, and of nature's God. I'd like to say that happened. I have no idea that happened. Probably didn't happen. But he put it in there. The separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God, capital G-O-D, no small g, entitle them a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires them that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. In the Declaration of the Rights of Man in France, you will not find that reference. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. That's really not true in the literal sense of the word. There are some of you, if we arm wrestled here, you'd beat me. But if I played you pool, I'd beat you probably. Probably. Sorry. Evidence of my misspent youth. Still trying to hustle. There are some of you who are quicker, more capable of conceptual thinking than I am. I'm just a plotter. There are some of you here who probably know how to make money. I'm lost when it comes to making money. We're just not equal in certain areas, folks. That's the way God made us. There's some people that are leaders, there's some people that aren't leaders. That's the way God made us. What he meant was there's a certain equality before the law. That's our struggle. And he says that they are endowed by their Creator, capital C, with unalienable rights. And among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. This has become totally perverted today in the term of civil rights. They use this clause in the civil rights movement to totally pervert this. But nevertheless, two references in the first two paragraphs, two references in the last paragraph written by Jefferson, who the liberals want to claim, liberals who are anti-theistic, want to claim as their hero. We, therefore, the representatives of the United States of America in General Congress assembled, appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions, do in the name and by the authority of the good people in these colonies solemnly publish and declare that these United Colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved. Supreme Judge, capital S, capital J. And that as free and independent states, they have full power to levy war, conclude peace, contract alliances, establish commerce, and do all other acts and things which independent states may of right do. And for the support of this declaration, with firm reliance on the protection of capital D, capital P, divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. Amen. Amen, Thomas. 56 signers of the Declaration of Independence. 25 were lawyers and jurists. Some of these people had been pastors. 11 were merchants. 9 were farmers of large plantation owners. These were men of means and education. They signed the declaration knowing full well the penalty would be death if they were captured. They put their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor at stake. They were not wild-eyed, rabble-rousing ruffians. They weren't out looking for a fight. They had just come to the place where they said, enough is enough. And this will be our course of action. This led, of course, directly into the American Revolutionary War, and from that, our liberty from England and the framing of the Constitution, which we'll take up tomorrow morning. We'll close in prayer. You'll have a few minutes, I guess, before to refresh yourself before we eat. Now, we do trust all of us visitors. By the way, isn't there a good number of visitors here from so far away? Just exciting. We're so glad that you folks drove so far or flew or whatever you did. We're glad you're here. And the folks at this church have just given us a good luck potluck, or will give us a good luck potluck. So hope everybody can stay and have fellowship. Let's close in prayer. Father, I thank you for the foresight of this church to have this type of a meeting. I thank you personally for the opportunity to be involved. I thank you for every person that's come. I'm particularly challenged by high school and college young people. I pray that they'll be exercised and stimulated to know more of this